Hello, this is Sounds Choral. When the pandemic hit in March, the curtain came down on performing arts, and because of the nature of COVID-19, an iron curtain on singing and the choral art. The next 3 weeks will be a Zoom roundtable discussion with our illustrious roster of hosts for this program, talking about their beloved art form. This week, we'll hear from each of them as to what was lost when this hit in March. Next week, we'll bring it up to the present and what they are doing to facilitate singing in some fashion. And week three, we'll look past the pandemic and how this will and might change choral music moving forward. All the music you'll hear in these programs was chosen by the hosts. We recorded this roundtable last Wednesday, the last day of September. And as we move into the fall and what follows the festive holiday season, where choral music is so woven into the fabric of celebrations, we begin with the setting of a medieval text. Music by one of our Sounds Choral hosts, Stephen Semetz, as he leads his Princeton singers in Gaudete.
Gaudete, 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 Gaudete,
Gaudete,
Gaudete,
Gaudete,
Gaudete.
Welcome to Sounds Choral. I'm David Ozenberg, the producer of this weekly program, a program that seeks to present the vast body of choral repertoire in a way that is intelligible, relevant, entertaining, and uplifting. And it has done all that for so many thousands of years, but since March, much of the world has not been able to experience the joy of the choral art. And since this station hosts one of the best choral programs on a weekly basis with our illustrious roster of hosts, once COVID hit back in March, and we knew that it was aerosol-borne, and we knew that it would not only send the curtain down on performing arts, but almost an iron curtain on singing, my thought was at some point to have our illustrious panel of hosts come together and talk about the choral art. And of course, as the goalpost has kept moving back on this pandemic, we didn't know what was the right time to do this. And we decided now is the right time here as we enter into the fall and into the month of October. And though you know their voices, I thought I would let them introduce themselves to you as they do whenever they host the program. And then I would like them each to take us back to that moment in March when not only the curtain came down on performing arts, but once we knew the scope of things, what they had to do professionally with their ensembles, but just going through their minds initially when they knew that the choral art, the art of singing, would be deeply affected.
Hi, listeners. This is Ryan Brando. I am the director of three ensembles, Princeton for Musica, the Mama Civic Chorus, and Amar Artists. Like many ensembles that are in the post-collegiate volunteer chorus sphere, many of us have 3 to 4 concerts a year. And with all of my ensembles, those work out to somewhere in the fall, somewhere in December, March, and May. So when all of this broke or came to our attention in a very urgent way, I was in the midst of preparing all three groups for a March performance. I guess you could say I got lucky, I don't know if that's the right word to use, in that I was able to perform on March 8th. I performed Handel's Solomon that day, his oratorio with Amor Artis and with the New York Baroque Incorporated Orchestra. We got that one in just under the wire. You know, it was the first time that I had elbow bumped a concertmaster instead of shaking hands. But then the very next day, I began a series of emergency board meetings with the other ensembles trying to figure out what was to happen with performances on March 15th and March 29th. And as you might imagine, the decision was made to cancel those performances in March. And then shortly thereafter, there were more emergency board meetings, and we determined we would cancel the May performances as well. As it became clear that what we do, gathering many people together on stage and many people together in an audience, wasn't in the best interest of anyone's safety. Fortunately, those decisions were, while heartbreaking, very clear and very swift, and we were able to switch into a different mode. So the first thing that I think so many of us had to deal with was that notion of heartbreak, the hours of blood, sweat, and tears that go into preparing something. Particularly, you know, something like Solomon was a big undertaking for Amor Artis. The group hadn't done a complete oratorio in quite some time, and there was a lot of enthusiasm, and we were able to share in that on March 8th. But the next concert I had was going to be a performance of James Whitburn's Annalise, which the singers of Princeton Musica had invested in so much, not just musically, but spiritually and emotionally. They felt so devoted to telling that story. And so that opportunity was, when it was taken away, I think was very difficult for many of them. I think that they had robbed the history of Anne Frank of some opportunity to be told. And likewise with my other March program. So we immediately kind of snapped into, well, first of all, how can we make sure that all of the artists that were engaged for these performances are taken care of? Because just as we were meeting to cancel performances for the rest of the season, and then shortly thereafter canceling the coming season, my heart went out to all of those professional musicians whose calendars and books were suddenly just full of excess. And so we tried to find ways to work within our budgets to provide either complete or partial payment to anyone we had hired for the rest of the season, likewise with the professional singers among our ranks. And then I, like I'm sure so many of us, tried to think about, well, how can we keep the essence of what we're doing moving forward? We all continued to gather on a weekly basis as we normally would. And I tried to find ways to engage our musical minds and musical hearts in those next coming weeks through a series of listening exercises and sight singing exercises and sort of critical group listening. We had some wonderful guests come in and talk to us, work with us on a bunch of vocal things. We did some historical exploration, and I imagine later in the program we'll talk about what we're up to now. It was quite a moment, but I was really happy with that all of the couple hundred singers that I work with saw the bigger picture and were able to grieve the loss of music making, but to above all prioritize the safety of their groups and their patrons and their communities.
Thank you.
Music of the English Renaissance composer William Byrd, the Agnus Dei movement, from his Mass for Four Voices, sung by the gentleman called New York Polyphony.
Hi, everyone. My name's Gabriel Crouch. I am the founder and director of the UK-based vocal ensemble Gallicantus and the director of choral activities at the very much New Jersey-based University of Princeton. And so in the capacity as director of those two very different sets of musicians. Life, as it was for Ryan, was pretty strongly impacted by what happened at the very beginning of March. Actually, at Princeton, I was incredibly lucky. We were all very lucky in the fact that we did have a concert on February the 28th, right before all of this went down, which was quite an exciting event. And it did at least feel like we got to a hurdle point. But of course, you know, as with every university, the spring is all about the seniors. It's all about the students who are going through all of this for the very last time, and for whom that sense of meaning has been accumulating over years and has really been built to a kind of explosion point in their senior year, where there's a sudden release of emotion and energy. And there was a real sense that we were right at that tipping point where that was all ready to happen, and we were about to push headlong into a new rehearsal sequence for our end-of-year concert, which was going to be music by Sarah Kirkland Snyder and Caroline Shaw. And of course, we were robbed of it, like everybody else. I think at that time, it felt like the most important thing to do in those circumstances was just to keep the community together, and using, which I'm sure we all have in common, you know, just making sure that we found excuses to get together. Back in those days, we weren't doing so much learning, I don't think. It didn't really feel appropriate at the end of the year, and especially in an institution like ours, where nobody does any singing for credit or because they have to in any way. They do it because they love it. And so that idea of focusing on what keeps people together in service of something that they love rather than in the search of a grade was very important to us. The great thing about the spring, as opposed to right now, is that our communities had already been formed. We'd already done 7 or 8 months of rehearsing and performing and touring and partying and laughing and joking and all those things that happen around the fringes of actual rehearsal that make our choral communities so rewarding to be part of. So we really focused on, you know, being together once, twice, three times a week, doing stupid stuff. You know, my favorite thing that we did was an online cabaret, like an open mic, really, it was, where lots and lots of students had to, especially the seniors, it was more or less compulsory for the seniors, but they had to come up with something that was nothing to do with the singing that we do in choir. It was something else. Two students created a Monteverdi duet dressed as characters from Tiger King, for instance, but one of them was in Boston and one of them was in DC, and, you know, they submitted these separate videos which they edited together, and it became a Tiger King episode, you know, in the form of Monteverdi, Zephyr, or Torna. It was crazy stuff like that. My wife and I did a TikTok dance, which you're never going to see. We also, Ryan knows this, we typically end our year with a Mass current and alumni performance of Speminalium, which is always a, you know, pretty cacophonous affair and very, very jolly. You know, we really wanted to find a way to recreate that. So I ended up asking the 5 students who are in my vocal concert program at Princeton to each of them to record 8 parts of Speminalium. So we ended up assembling a 40-part Speminalium from 5 students, which we released at that moment in reunions when we would have been all meeting together as a choir of 250, as we normally are, and performing that piece. So that was quite fun. Came out okay. In the professional realm, Gallicantus had a bunch of exciting things over the spring, including a Wigmore Hall recital in London on Easter Saturday, which obviously had to be shelved. To be perfectly honest, I mean, I'm a member of a large family. I'm one of 5 kids, all of whom are musicians, and all my siblings are freelance musicians. And the freelance musical experience in the UK has been particularly difficult because there is not the government support that there is in continental Europe, and there is not the private support that there is in the USA. And so a lot of these, you know, world-class singers have been left completely marooned, and a lot of them have already, you know, sold their instruments and retrained or are driving delivery vans and everything else that people are having to do just to get by right now. And for them, it was really just a matter of scraping together what we could, trying to persuade promoters and concert venues to part with small percentages of the fee, maybe as an advance against a rescheduled event, and see if we could provide Gallicantus singers. That's a very long story, which is for another radio episode, I'm sure. But the life of freelance musician in the UK has been very, very tough over the course of this, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better, unfortunately. So some happy stuff and some sad stuff from me.
Jesus, Mater Dei, kill.
Mano tuga lasta, come unto me, ye children, an Estonian melody, and in that language, part of an album of runic songs and folk hymns set in unpretentious arrangements by Heine Vanker.
I'm James Jordan, Westminster Choir College, conductor of Williamson Voices, conductor of the same string choir, and also the kind of one of the many faculty at the Choral Institute of Oxford. So I listened with envy to my colleagues, and I wish that's all I was having to deal with was the pandemic. But as you'll hear, our plates are a little more full. Let me back up to January. We were very fortunate. I thought at the time I was crazy, but I did a recording with the same stream on the music of Patrick Hawes the first week of January, and Williamson Voices did another recording the third week of January, which I never do. But I thought, well, we're going to do it. And thank God we did, because that was the last time, essentially, that we kind of performed together. And both of those recordings were godsends in so many, many ways. And as it's turned out, same stream also had two other recordings kind of in the can that I just didn't have time to listen to the edits and Andrew Miller mix them. The pandemic had a slight silver lining in that we all had extra time. Adrian Peacock produced the recording. So the nice thing is that within the year, within this period when we're not singing together, both ensembles have two recordings coming out, and that is a blessing. It was very emotional because one of those recordings, which was done 2 years ago in January, was finished. And it, like Gabriel said, I was just trying in the spring to figure out things to do to keep the community together. And probably the most moving day we had is when I thought we had our listening party. And I think it reminded us of the things painfully that we've been without. And it was a very, very emotional day. My story and the story of Williamson Voices in Westminster Choir College is a little bit more poignant. So as it turns out, we were preparing the Kyle Smith Consolation of Apollo, Had It Learned. We had begun work with the Japanese artist Makoto Fujimura for a pretty incredible visual experience in the Basilica of Philadelphia to go with that program. We never got to sing the piece, as my colleagues have explained with their own choirs, and that was a deep disappointment because we could love the piece and Kyle. And so Kyle came and talked with us, but the horrible part of all of this, if I can just say, is that As you all probably are aware, Westminster was slated to be moved to the Ryder campus. And so we were all figuring out how we would say goodbye to this little plot in Princeton. It was a silent funeral, kind of, on campus all semester to that point. We had alumni showing up just to walk into Bristol Chapel one last time, and it was particularly heart-wrenching when they would walk in during your rehearsal and stand in the back of the room and cry. As it turned out, the last day we were all on campus was the grad recital day, where each grad student in symphonic choir got half of symphonic choir. One did Fern Hill. I forget what the other part of the program was. But it was supposed to be on that weekend. It was moved up, and only half the choir could be in the choir singing was the only choir could be in the room. There was some socially distant seats. This was just when we knew we were going to be shut down, and we wanted to get these in. It was the worst performance I've ever been at. Not musically, it was unbelievable singing. But somehow we all knew that this would be our last time on campus. When the concert was over, I have never heard such silence, mingled with tears. And then we were locked down. So not only were we having to figure out how to keep the community together, but how to keep a broken community together. It has been difficult. I'll tell you what we're doing now that we're moved. But cleaning out my office of 30 years was not a pleasant day for me. As one of my colleagues said, the students never had a chance to say goodbye. And that's hard for musicians and artists and for the history of that school to just one day, that's it. So our pain and our sadness and our disappointment, as Ryan was saying for his own choir, is magnified exponentially. It was the saddest time of my teaching career. We never talked about it, but we all knew. Out on the quad that day, the students knew they would never be back. And that was painful. So we, again, like my colleagues, the same stream is on hiatus. We had three more recordings planned, one for August. Obviously, we're just on a time delay. But the other sad thing about this is that the highlight of, as Gabriel said, for his seniors, the highlight for my students is Oxford. This, we are now in our eighth year. And that has become a rite of passage. We perform. They love to help conductors. And at the end of the 2 weeks, it's quite an emotional experience. Well, they were robbed of that also. And also for those of you who don't or have never been there, a Westminster commencement is unlike any other on the planet. And our seniors were robbed of that. So it's been really painful and really difficult in a school that revolves around choral music. So we soldiered on. We kept the community together. I'm proud of that. And I'll be happy to share with you how we move forward in this new year. But basically, ours was a little bit of a more difficult load to hold, to haul. But everybody's healthy. And I guess that's something to be thankful for.
Dr. Jordan there conducting his same stream choir from a recording that will be released soon, a setting of a Quaker text by Jackson Hill, To Hold the Light, which is also the name of the CD, this a world premiere performance.
Hi, I'm Steven Samets. I'm the Ronald J. Ulrich Professor of Music at Lehigh University, where I'm the Director of Choral Activities and conduct the Choral Union, Glee Club, and the University Choir. I am also happy to be the Artistic Director of the Princeton Singers. And just to make that distinction between Gabriel saying how much wonderful stuff was going on at the university and his groups, Princeton Singers is of the community and not affiliated with the university, but is a group of 16 professional singers who were scheduled to do their 38th season this coming year. And of course, we're finding ways to do things that we creatively can keep going artistically in an era where singers are now super spreaders. We have a hard time considering ourselves that, but that's in fact where we find ourselves. If I put myself back to March, it was an abrupt wake up. I went to the ACDA Rochester conference on March 6th. I gave my choir Thursday night off, and I never saw them again. It was surreal. We were preparing a concert called Groundbreakers. It was going to be with Princeton Singers. It had all kinds of new music on it. And we sort of declared ourselves, we couldn't sing safely. I couldn't guarantee that the people coming to my groups could have a safe environment to sing in. The university was, of course, scrambling to try to figure out what protocols to adopt. We were all in this kind of no man's land that we didn't know what to do. And I think we came up with interesting solutions, which we can address a little bit later, but I'm very struck by Jim's description of the what happened at Westminster, because it's that feeling about being close family. And I think we should all be thinking about, you know, how our communities were affected and what we were doing to keep the communities going. But it just struck me as parallel and analog for how many families couldn't say goodbye to loved ones during this time. And that's basically what Jim was alluding to. So we have this community as choral singers where we exist not just for the music and not just for the artistry, although that is primary, but it is the community and the loved ones around us. And suddenly they were gone. That must be so much more wrenching when it's your direct family. But for us as a choral community, it just put us into trauma. And we are recovering from that with, I think, the resilience that is the hallmark of choral singers and choral conductors. Choral conductors are basically just crazy people. I think I have esteemed colleagues here, but I am sure we all have stories about driving, you know, 2 to 3 hours in snowstorms to get to rehearsals where normal people would say, why are you doing that? And we do it because we're a little crazy about our art and about our community. And we find ourselves at this time asking not just the artistic questions about, you know, what are we going to do to keep the music going? We are really concerned with how are we going to keep our communities going? These people that are largely amateurs, I exclude Princeton Singers and many other that we've talked about today, but, you know, amateurs in the best sense of people that love what they do and miss what they do. And we are so aware right now of the subtlety of what happens in a rehearsal hall, that when we walk in and we just breathe together, or we sing an A together, or make a phrase together, and that used to be what we were used to doing. We knew how to do that, and the resonance that came out of that, both spiritually and harmonically and physically, we took that for granted almost. We were art smiths at doing that thing, but that's what we wanted to do, and it's gone. I think we're being put in a place where we're trying to deal with a technology very ill-suited to do that. And we're dealing with, at least in my case of now, trying to teach my students who are all in little tiles on a Zoom. It's trying to break down that boundary and keep the sense of community that is so much in the front of my mind right now.
Thank you.
University of Georgia Hodgson Singers, conducted by Dr. Daniel Barra, perform a setting of I've Been in the Storm So Long by Jeffrey Ames.
So many of the same experiences we share. I'm Deborah Simpkin King. My world revolves around Manhattan and northern New Jersey. I'm the founder and artistic director of Schola Cantorum on Hudson, which is the parent organization of Project Encore, also of the performing ensemble Ember and of the education program Phoenix. I'm also a church musician. I'm on and off campus various times, but I'm not on a campus position this year. If I might, just 1 minute, Westminster story that maybe is a little bit of levity. You don't know what I have in my living room. It's a pew from the chapel. James, I don't know if you remember when there was a pile of pews that was going to be carted off when the chapel was being redone. Well, my son, Michael King, and my daughter-in-law, Hannah Miller King, saw that pile and they said, no, they can't all just disappear. They can't just be carted off. So they put it in the back of the truck of their two apartments of things. They'd just gotten married that were coming to live in my basement for a summer while they relocated. And when everything was off that truck, except one thing, I looked in and I said, there's a pew in the truck. Where is that going to live? And 10 years later, it's still living in my living room from the chapel. So a piece of Westminster in a very unusual form lives on, and it will go down to them in South Carolina soon. But it's a permanent piece of their lives as Westminster students and has been for my life, in my life for a decade. My story has resonance with those that have been told. We performed not on the 28th, but on the 29th of February, Leap Day, and on March 1st. We always do back-to-back concerts, one in Manhattan, one in northern New Jersey. And we had just finished our performances. We actually had a party that next weekend in my Manhattan apartment. And then the following Tuesday, we had the last rehearsal that we would have. Didn't know it at the time. We did know there were concerns. We weren't sure what the next week would look like, but surely the week after that, things would be fine. And of course, we all know where that went. So this was the ensemble Ember. We were in the midst of a season that we called Listen, and the fall concert had been called Civil Discourse. You know, we can all, I'm sure, understand why we chose this theme at this particular moment in this country's history. The concert that we had just performed was called Outside Voices, representing people that were disenfranchised in various ways from our society. And we were in our 25th season. So it was an anniversary season for us. And our final concert that was to be in May that didn't happen was a double world premiere, combination of two works, one from Rob Patterson, another from Eric Banks. And that concert was to be called Voices of the Earth. How do we listen to the voices of our earth? What are we being told? And of course, that concert did not happen. It's reprogrammed for this coming May, and we're assuming that that will happen at that time. As we've heard expressed from each of us, the desire to stay together, the heightened awareness of the core essence, elements of the core essence of what choral singing is, I think became so prominent in not only our minds, but in our hearts and in our spirits, our souls. And we knew that even though we could not make resonance together in the same room as we are accustomed to doing and find that, you know, flock of birds, school of fish kind of movement through the air, through shared breath, shared resonance, we knew that as a community, we process life together through music, through singing. So very much like the other stories that we've heard here, we did not miss a week of rehearsal. It's just that rehearsal took on a very different meaning. I'd say that if rehearsals had been 80-85% artistic and 15% social and emotional, those ratios were flipped. Everybody had stories, everybody had concerns and fears. Many of our singers were geographically displaced. Many still are geographically displaced. And yet one of the joys, we tried to focus on the joys and the blessings in a time of deprivation, but one of the joys and blessings is what we can do electronically and that we can still come together and share experiences and share our hearts and our journeys. We learn to manage to do something, at least to make sound, at least to sing music that we knew or music that we could be working on Zoom. But it's not, you know, obviously you're not really making progress with rehearsals in the same way, but it brought us together. And that was what was so important. We have continued. We took several weeks off variously during the summer, but pretty much we kept it going even during what is normally a dormant season for us in the summer. But the group continued to want to be together. I think the social elements, the spiritual and emotional elements of what we all share in our choral families, which I think we've all spoken to, the family element, that needed to continue, and I think it was of heightened importance. I found a similar thing even with my little church choir. Again, with that group, we didn't miss a week of coming together. We called it rehearsal, not quite, but we came together and shared our stories and our concerns. And I think that's the core of which we've all been reminded during this time in which so much has been taken away, is, you know, what is our essence and what can we provide for our singers when we can't provide the normal rehearsal performance experience.
Thank you.
Stephen Darlington led Christ Church Cathedral Choir Oxford in the opening Kyrie from Ralph Vaughan Williams' Mass in G Minor, a work written as Britain was emerging from World War I and the Spanish flu, the work making the statement, choral music is still here.
Hi, I'm Ethan Sperry, and I'm the Barry Stoll Professor of Choral Music at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon, and also the Artistic Director and Conductor of the Oregon Repertory Singers, a community chorus based in the Portland, Oregon area. And I'm just going to start by fangirling, because I've never actually had a chance to meet James Jordan, but I've got to tell you, Portland State's program is primarily a music education program, and your sense for the resources that have been needed to train teachers has just, it's been amazing over the course of my career as I've watched you and the textbooks that you've either written or edited. It's life-changing, and thank you for that legacy for our field and knowing what was needed. It's just invaluable, and on behalf of all of my students, just thank you for doing that work. It's really exquisite. Yeah, just I guess echoing what everybody else said, it's a similar story. I also got very lucky. I had two major events the weekend of February 29th and March 1st. Oregon Repertory Singers had our big fundraiser gala on February 29th, and had that been a couple of weeks later, I don't know what sort of financial shape our organization would be in. And then on March 1st, I put on this big concert. My university at Portland State built a new basketball arena that actually has exquisite acoustics for concerts. And we actually invited Eric Whitaker up and formed a giant mass high school choir of 300 high school kids from around the Portland area. And my 150 Portland State singers and my three audition choirs and our wind symphony. And I was sort of optimistically expecting 1,000 or 1,500 people in the audience, but we actually had the largest audience for a concert of choral music in the history of Portland. We had almost 3,000 people show up for the concert, in addition to the 500 performers. It was quite something. And I have no idea when something like that will be able to occur again. Going right back to March, I don't think any of us were aware of how poorly equipped all our various infrastructures were to handle this pandemic. I remember thinking, oh yeah, we'll lock down for 4 weeks and then we're gonna be able to, like we had a 10-week spring quarter and I really thought we'd probably be able to sing by the end of the quarter. And we started doing things online with the thought that we might be like in a room together. And even how recently some organizations have canceled the stuff up through January, the Oregon Symphony here is still, you know, has not canceled its January through the end of the season. There's been this sort of sense of like not really knowing and like that benchmark keeping moving. So what Stephen said about resilience really speaks to me, but I feel like for a lot of us, we've made even so many different iterations of plans that have all been canceled. Or, you know, we just keep pushing things back and keep pushing things back, but I'm just remembering all these various things I thought I could do that like vanished, not just the initial thing, but that sense of the goalposts moving. And that made it, I think, hard, the first part, to grieve the loss that was happening. Because we weren't grieving it, we were like fighting and trying to like keep going. And then, like James said, a lot of our communities sort of vanished before we even necessarily got to the grieving process. It's been so hard to put together the timeline. But it just also occurs to me that in this field, for those of us who love choral music, either as singers, conductors, or audience members, choral music is what we use to process so many of the losses in life. It's just one of those places we turn when life doesn't go the way we want. And the very thing that we lean on, the communities that we come together with and the art that gets us through just isn't possible right now. So it's like, not only are we not able to make the art, we don't even have like the mental health care that we need. Like, I mean, there are reasons all these studies show that the choral singers are happier than other people and have better mental health support. We have stronger communities and we have a way of expressing and trying to process loss. And all of these things have been taken from us in addition to the very concrete events. My adult choir was supposed to go on tour to Argentina this summer. And ironically, just like James, my college choir had been learning the Consolation of Apollo. We also didn't get to perform the Consolation of Apollo. And we were supposed to sing it at the World Symposium in New Zealand. And I was so excited to bring that music to that audience. And just that cycle of loss is so profound for all of us. And then also the tool that we use to deal with that loss is gone too. It's very deep and it's very painful.
We will be back here next week with part two of the Zoom roundtable with our roster of illustrious Sounds Choral hosts, as recorded this past Wednesday, September 30th. Next week, we'll turn to where they are with their choirs today, and also logistics, ideas, and hopes for singing in some fashion now. Earlier, we heard some music of English Renaissance composer William Byrd, and we'll close with a motet of his, Civitas Sancti, the text translating to, "Your holy city has become a wilderness. Zion has become a wilderness. Jerusalem has been made desolate." It is sung by Choir of New College Oxford, led by Edward Higginbottom. I'm David Ozenberg, producer of Sounds Choral, which is produced at the studios of WWFM, the Classical Network. You can listen to any recent Sounds Choral program by going to our website, wwfm.org, and clicking on Classical and Webcasts. You can also support programming like this with a donation in membership at our website. Thanks so much for listening. Sounds Choral is an exclusive production of the award-winning Classical Network and wwfm.org.